So let's focus on the US inflation data that was released last week. It was an August number, and inflation in the US has moved from 3.2% up to 3.7%. Now, obviously, that's not encouraging when you're trying to get inflation down to the target of 2%. During the month, prices rose by 0.6%, which is also on the high side. But if we break down the data, we can clearly see that the increase in the oil price, effectively the increase in the gasoline price in the US, was the main contributor to that upward pressure. Outside of oil prices, there wasn't a significant increase in the price index, and I think key areas continue to moderate. In particular, food inflation has softened further, shelter inflation has eased, and in general, we have got evidence that there's a easing of inflationary pressure more broadly in the US economy. That doesn't mean that the Federal Reserve can be complacent, because clearly if the oil price moves up further, if house prices, the reacceleration that we've seen in recent months takes hold more fully, if wages don't moderate, then inflation can find itself sticky at well over 3%, forcing the Federal Reserve to hike rates further. At this stage, I think the Federal Reserve can keep rates on hold, and they meet again this week, and I think they'll do exactly that. But as we look further out, there is some uncertainty later in this year as to whether or not the Federal Reserve is going to be forced to increase rates further. Our view is that we've reached the top of the US interest rate cycle for the moment, and that during the course of next year, we think that interest rates can systematically be cut into 2025. When we focus on core inflation, that number moved lower. It was at 4.7%. It's eased off to 4.3%. And that, I think, is certainly encouraging, although the 4.3% clearly still way away from the 2% target. So the Federal Reserve still has work to do. They've got to keep interest rates elevated. They can't consider cutting interest rates anytime soon. But I think broadly, the inflation numbers are moving in the right direction. Last week, the European Central Bank decided to increase interest rates by a further 25 basis points, taking the refinancing rate up to 4.5%. That 4.5% is actually quite high by historical standards, and certainly in restrictive territory. Ahead of the meeting, the consensus was expecting interest rates to actually remain unchanged, and I think many people were focusing on the weakness that we've seen in European economic activity. But if you look at it from the ECB's perspective, inflation is just too sticky. It's well above the target of 2%. And clearly they feel they've got to add to the interest rate pressure in order to get inflation to move closer to target. Now, there's no doubt that the latest increase in interest rates will aggravate the weakness that we've already seen. And I've monitored a range of forecasts, all being revised lower. Many people now think that Germany will experience an outright recession. Yet, the ECB is adamant that they've got to get inflation under control, and I think that should be applauded. That is ultimately what their job is about. Now, the more interesting aspect to this decision was the press conference that followed the announcement. And at the press conference, Christine Lagarde made it clear that she thinks the current level of interest rate is restrictive enough. In other words, what she's arguing is that if European interest rates remain at these levels for a period of time, then inflation will be brought under control. And I think that's another way of them saying that they feel they're at the top of the interest rate cycle and that the next move will be lower, although you wouldn't expect that decrease in interest rates to occur until we're well into 2024. The market actually liked that story, even though the interest rate surprised on the upside, and perhaps that's the key message. The message is the sooner the major central banks get definitively to the top of the interest rate cycle, the more it will ease some of the concerns, some of the pressure that we've seen in financial markets. The third aspect I think we need to talk about is some of the activity data we've seen out of China, as well as some of the numbers presented out of South Africa. If I look at the Chinese economic data, definitely surprised on the upside, particularly retail sales and industrial production. That doesn't mean the data was wildly positive, but in the last couple of months, we've seen some of the Chinese data soften, and the data presented last week is certainly an improvement to the upside. It doesn't mean we're revising up our growth estimates for China, but it perhaps suggests that there's some stability emerging within the Chinese economy and that the recent stimulus that the authorities have introduced is probably having a positive effect. We still don't think that China will introduce a massive stimulus program, but rather add to the support through incremental changes. And I think that's going to be the pattern for the rest of the year, working on the idea that the cumulative effect of all of these changes ultimately benefit the Chinese economy. Hopefully the data gets supported over the next couple of months, but it was certainly an encouraging set of numbers. If we then look across to South African data, distinctly weak. These are July numbers for manufacturing and mining activity, and it was weak across the board. And the improvement that we had seen in the second quarter of this year seemed to suddenly evaporate. And clearly there's ongoing pressure within our productive sectors. Our industrial production in this country remains problematic, partly because of the constant electricity outages, but also other factors in terms of infrastructure problems with rail and port capacity, and just generally weak confidence. So I think those numbers will present a bit of a concern, especially if you're National Treasury, because clearly it does suggest that tax revenue will remain under pressure. And right now there's a huge focus on the fiscal slippage that is unfolding in South Africa. We'll get an update of that when we get the October medium-term budget, but I am expecting that the Minister of Finance will have to heavily revise some of his estimates and acknowledge that government finances is not as good as it has been over the last couple of years, and that the benefits we saw out of the bumper mining tax revenue have disappeared, and that it's going to be tougher now to achieve the budget outcome. All of that would suggest that government has to pay careful attention to their expenditure programs and try to get those under control, which is obviously quite challenging as you go into an election year. Lastly, I've been asked to talk about the possible introduction of a BRICS currency. Now, this made headlines at the time of the BRICS summit that was held a couple of weeks ago in Johannesburg. And I think as a concept, it makes very little sense. I can understand from a political perspective why some of the BRICS community would argue in favor of common currency. But in order for that to be implemented, the countries that are involved have to be similar. They have to have similar dynamics regarding inflation, regarding fiscal policy, and most important, regarding monetary policy. In many sense, they have to have exactly the same interest rate, and you can see that within the euro area. The reason is that if a couple of countries all have the same currency but vastly different interest rates, then all that's going to happen is the money is going to simply flow to the country that offers the highest interest rate, because you face no currency risk. That would cause huge disturbances in any economic system and major disturbances amongst the BRICS countries. It means that individual countries have to give up autonomy around their central bank, the determination of interest rates, the inflation target, and I just can't see the BRICS countries being willing to do that. Certainly not the way in which the euro area has achieved their unification. So let's use a real example about some of the countries that are now members of the BRICS, and I'm going to focus on Argentina. At the moment, Argentina's interest rate is up at 118%. And the reason is that inflation has got completely out of control. It sits at over 100%, forcing the central bank to hike interest rates. Now, imagine that Argentina and China have exactly the same currency. Let's call it a BRICS currency. Then clearly what would happen, because Chinese interest rates are around 4%, the money would simply flow to Argentina. Why would you not? Why would you not take your money and invest it in Argentina, earning 118%, and face no currency risk? It would simply be impractical. It would not work. Now, you can argue that, yes, if all of these countries had the same currency, then you wouldn't have these big differences in inflation and interest rates. But in order to introduce a common currency to start with, you need commonality. You need these countries to be similar. That was certainly the exercise that the euro area embarked on before they introduced the euro. They had to agree on certain parameters, achieve those parameters, and then they could move forward with the introduction of the euro. I can't see that being achieved within the BRICS community. These countries are hugely diverse. They would want to maintain their own autonomy. I simply can't see all of these countries agreeing to adhere to certain fiscal parameters, debt levels, interest rate levels, and a whole range of other macroeconomic indicators. And so as a concept, it is unworkable, it is impractical, and it would never come about. The idea of de-dollarization, on the other hand, has some merit, and that says that the dollar is too dominant in the world and that we need to see a dissipation of that dominance. And one way to do that is for individual countries to actively use their own currency when they trade with another country and not simply revert to the dollar as the common currency of usage. Now, there is some progress that can be made in that regard, but there are real practical reasons why people use the dollar. It's not necessarily that they like the US or that they think that the dollar is an especially good currency, but it is just simply practical, convenient to use the dollar. Imagine receiving a huge amount of Argentinian peso for something you've sold to Argentina, and now you're trying to take the Argentinian currency and move that through the currency market to somebody else. Is there a natural buyer for Argentinian currency? And my suspicion is no. Whereas for the dollar, undoubtedly, there's a huge market that is very liquid. So I think some progress can be made on increasing the use of individual currencies, and probably that would systematically undermine the role of the dollar, but I don't think it's going to make headway in a significant way anytime soon. That would take a long period of time for people to grow accustomed to using other currency. And I think many businesses, many customers will keep reverting back to using the dollar because it makes the most practical sense. In the end, when I look at the BRICS countries together, my feeling is that this is a group of countries that are really anti-US. That's the key commonality amongst them. And that is not the recipe for economic success, to get together to try and undermine the dominance of the US, try and undermine the dominance of the dollar, doesn't automatically generate economic success. And if I listen to a lot of these discussion points around de-dollarization or BRICS currency, I get the overwhelming feeling that this is more about trying to weaken the US than it is about trying to strengthen the BRICS currency. And I don't think practically that will go anywhere in a significant way. So that's all from me for this week. Hope that makes some sense, and we'll catch up again in a week's time. Thanks a lot.